ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, the current geopolitical landscape surrounding rare earth minerals is defined by intensifying competition between the US and China, and Australia has emerged as a pivotal ally. China dominates the global rare earths market. It controls around 70% of the mining of them, and up to 90%, critically, of the processing capacity of these things. Now, in response to China's tightening export controls, when they have used it as a weapon against the US, the US has accelerated efforts to diversify supply chains, and they've tried to shore up alliances, with including Australia, with countries that can perhaps break the Chinese stranglehold. Why are these rare earth minerals so important anyway? And more importantly, what are they? They're the sort of thing I think we wander around in conversations saying, yeah, rare earths, without actually understanding what they are. Joining us tonight, two guests, expert in their field, to help us unpack this. Associate Professor Marina Zhong is an academic and author and commentator at the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney. She researches the global geopolitics of technologies. She's written three books, holds a PhD and an MBA from ANU, and regularly advises governments as well. Marina, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
It's very good to have you with us too. And now, there had to be someone on the tools here. Associate Professor Carl Spandler is my man. He's a geologist at the University of Adelaide, specialising in petrology, mineralogy and geochemistry. Has a doctorate from the Australian National University and researches critical metal ore deposits like RWEs, cobalt and lithium. And he knows a rare earth when he sees one. Carl, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having me on the program.
No, it's great to have you both with us, and thanks for your expertise. Carl, can we go first to you? What are they, anyway? The term rare earths and critical minerals covers a huge spectrum of things. I mean, or are they? Is it quite particular when we use this term as to what we mean?
Yeah, that term is being used a lot in the media in variable ways, I think, and it is probably worth unpacking a little bit. I mean, rare earths themselves are part of the critical minerals definition, so they are sort of a subset of critical minerals. So to think about what critical minerals are, there is a vast number of metals and commodities and actual minerals that fall into that group, and they're really a group that's probably been only around for a couple of decades. And they're really defined by two things. One is that they're commodities or metals that we really need, particularly for modern technology and our
We never used to need, but we need now.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, we always use them maybe in very small quantities, but we're going to need them in much bigger quantities. And the other aspect to make them critical is there is a supply risk. There's a risk that we will be able to actually access these particular metals, and that's really the one that sets them apart and defines them as being critical minerals.
Are they?
And the rare earths.
Yeah, go on.
I was just going to say the rare earths fall within that group. They're probably the most critical of the critical minerals in many cases.
Okay. How many rare earths are there?
Well, that depends on how you count them. There's different ways of thinking about them. There's somewhere between 13 and 15.
Okay.
But mostly the rare earths themselves are what we call the lanthanides. So they're a row of elements that sit towards the bottom of the periodic table. And they're quite heavy elements, and they have quite unique properties, including very strong magnetism, and they can be luminescent as well, among other things. And that's where their really important applications come from.
Okay, so I understand in previous discussions with economists about this that they are not rare. Is that right? I mean, they're not rare in the Earth's crust.
No, not really. I mean, they're about as common as copper.
Okay.
And so in your average garden variety rock, you might find around the place, we're probably looking at 0.01% of the rock, which doesn't sound like much, but it isn't trivial either. So they're not particularly rare.
Okay, and are they found everywhere in the earth, or is it a bit like iron ore that valuable deposits are relatively rare?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you want to find a deposit where those concentrations get up to 1% or even in some cases 10% of the rock, and then you can think about looking at that material as an ore body of something that you can mine. And that's not very common, actually. That's really hard to find those concentrations of rare earths in one place.
Mm. When you say rare earths, I mean, like, do you tend to find all of these 13 to 15 because they're all closely associated on the periodic table? Do you find them all together?
Yes, you do. That's exactly right. Because they have such similar chemical behaviours, yeah. They tend to form together. They are locked in the same minerals in rocks, and so they do tend to follow each other to a large extent. So, yeah.
Okay. Do we have a lot of them or not? Australia.
In Australia, yeah, we do. We're actually not just rare earths, but a whole range of critical metals. We're very well endowed with a lot of these materials. And rare earths, they can be concentrated to make ore bodies in many different ways. And we're still sort of discovering new potential ore bodies all the time. So it's a very new field for geologists and for mineral explorers to try and find these things.
Right. Because we weren't looking for them before.
Yeah, that's right. We weren't looking for them before. It's only in the last couple of decades that we've started. They do get concentrated in ways that we probably didn't expect previously. And so we are finding out more about them all the time.
Mm. All right, 1-300-800-222 is the number. If you've got a question about rare earths and critical minerals, then give our experts a call. Professor Carl Spandler's with us, and Professor Marina Jung as well, Jung from the University of Technology. I want to ask her, Marina, in a moment about the geopolitics of this, but just getting to what these things are. Carl, so people historically have always looked for gold and silver and lead and iron and so on. It's only recently you're saying that people have started to look for these things. When you say recently, since when? Since the war or when?
Probably in a serious way in the last, say, 30, 40 years.
Right.
And that really comes from the development of modern technology, of computers, of these sort of advanced materials that we need these metals in. And so your comparison to other metals like copper or tin, et cetera, lead, we've been mining for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so that knowledge of where you would go in the landscape or where geologists would go to find those things is fairly mature. We know where to go to find copper in a broad sense. For a lot of these metals, we just don't know. We don't have that fundamental information, so we're kind of trying to catch up very quickly.
Give us an example of where you say they've got high magnetic qualities, which I'm sure is important. Give us an example. Yep. I mean, in my mobile phone, which is sitting beside me, turned off, thank heavens, but are there rare earths in there?
There is. So, an essential component of a speaker, for example, is a magnet. You need a magnet to make the diaphragm move to make the sound. And so there are tiny amounts of rare earths in your mobile phone. And you may think, well, that's only tiny amounts, probably less than a gram.
Yeah.
But when you think about the literally billions of mobile phones that are around the world, that adds up to quite a lot of rare earths. But that's one example. But if you think about the big demand on rare earths is coming from modern technology, but particularly the push for green energy. So things like the wind turbines we see around the landscape now, each of those in that turbine has a magnet that allows that rotational movement to be converted to electrical energy. And each of those magnets has about 200 to 300 kilos of rare earths.
Oh, really?
And, okay. And so that's now, we're starting to get to quite large volumes. Electric vehicles have an electric motor that has a magnet, a high-powered magnet that allows that motor to work. That also needs, many kilos of rare earths.
Did we always need rare earths to make magnets? Because magnets have been with us for a very long time, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. No, I mean, most magnets we have would be, you know, your fridge magnet on your that you use to
I mean,
hold
we
up
give away
bills.
A very, very precious fridge magnet here on the program every night, Carl, for the winner of our Mighty Challenge quiz, for example. What are you saying? What are you saying about what we're giving away?
I'm sure the magnet works very well as it is, but it probably doesn't have the rare earths in it that you need that these other magnets have, and it's only a few of the rare earths. So neodymium is the main one, and the reason why we add neodymium to the magnet. So most magnets are mostly iron, and we just put a little bit of neodymium in these magnets, and it just means that they can hold much higher magnetic potential.
So that's it. They're just very much more magnetic than the previous old magnets we had.
Yeah, that's right. They're much more powerful. So that means a motor can be
smaller.
Can be smaller and lighter for much more magnetic strength.
Oh, yep. Okay, got it. Okay, apart from magnets, what else might they be used for?
Definitely magnets is the biggest demand, but they're also they have these luminescent properties, so we use them in as well as the microphones and the speakers in your phone. Whenever you look at a screen, whether it's your phone screen or your tablet or your computer screen, whenever you're seeing reds and greens, those colors, that's actually rare earths luminescing. And so we use them for display screens as well.
Right. Are they dangerous metals? I mean, are they radioactive, for example?
Not really. Not really at all. There's one that's a little bit radioactive, but not on the sort of timescales that we're worried about, humans' timescales.
They're not toxic. Are they toxic to handle?
No, not really. So the rare earths themselves are fairly benign, but in geological situations where we find rare earth minerals, unfortunately, the nature of those minerals that take in rare earths also like to take in uranium and thorium, which are radioactive, obviously. So they are often, you will see occasionally people talking about radioactivity associated with rare earths. It's the uranium thorium that's associated with them rather than the rare earths themselves.
Okay, I want to get to talk to you about processing of these things shortly, but I want to bring in Marina here too. Marina Jung is an expert on the geopolitics of all this. Marina, how did China, I mean, China apparently set out to meticulously plan a path to world dominance in these things. Can you chart that for us? How did that take place?
Thank you. That's a very good question. China's dominance, obviously, was not the result of a single master plan overnight. So it's rather a decades-long process combining its industrial policy, cost advantages, government subsidies, consolidations, and a willingness to bear heavy environmental costs. So China actually went through a sort of three phases development of its dominance on rare earths. So at the very beginning, that's sort of between 1970s and 1990s, when rare earth magnets were not in high demand, China actually encouraged exports of low-cost rare earth products. Governments even subsidized by providing exporters through tax rebates and so on. And at that time, China actually had a lot of very low-cost miners and exporters, and they sent the products to countries in the US, Japan, and France for processing. And I think it's China started to realize the importance of rare earths by the end of the last century, and then China started to really consolidate its grips on rare earths in the 2000s. So China started to reduce export quotas and increase the taxes on raw materials, and also consolidated hundreds of small miners into a handful of state-owned miners and producers. So then in the really China started to develop a technology-driven global integration of rare earth supply chain actually in 2014-15 until now. So China focuses to R&D and established the national research hubs, labs for rare earths and downstream applications. So that's the rest is history. So by 2021, and China accounted for over 80% of patents in rare earths related technologies, and also became the world's largest importer of rare earths. Ours, including from Australia, for processing. And China also shifted to conserving its own reserves of especially heavy rare earth elements. So that's the sort of a three-stage process by which China has developed its dominance.
Okay. This deal that we've signed with the US in October, Marina, which I think, you can explain it if you can, but I understand it commits both the US and Australian governments to committing about $1 billion each into the mining, processing, and refining projects in both countries. What Carl tells us is these things are not rare; they are generally available, but you need application and money to dig up and process them. So, in a sense, the stranglehold that China has on these things can be broken if there's enough will here. It's not as though China possesses a particular natural advantage here, is it, or not?
Well, I mean, if you're judging from the technological breakthrough perspective, China is really using the 1980s chemistry technologies. So therefore there's nothing really specific or dramatic about that technology, but China has built this industrial fortress which the Western or any attempts to build a China free supply chain perhaps it will take about 10 to 15 years to match.
Right.
So that's the choke point China holds on the global supply chain.
Okay. So it's this narrow point right now, in the sense that no one can stop making mobile phones or missiles or wind towers or anything of that nature. And in this period, China really holds all the cards, as it were.
China indeed holds the card. But China is, until recently, China was not really weaponizing its control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one rare occasion was in 2010, China tested with Japan because of the island disputes with Japan. And that caused concerns from countries outside of China. And they realized, well, China actually holds this very significant supply chain. Any movement or the signals of movement can cause disruptions. So by at that time, Japan the first and started to develop China-free supply chain. But 15 years after that incident, Japan is still heavily relying on China's supply.
Right. Okay, interesting. We're talking about the geopolitics of critical minerals and rare earths. Marina Jung is with us, and also Carl Spandler. Marina's an expert on the global geopolitics of these technologies, and Carl Spandler is an Australian geologist and expert in the digging and processing of these things. Carl, back to you on this. The problem, you've explained that they're not rare particularly. You've explained that Australia has a good amount of these things distributed in the country. We may well be one of the major suppliers of them. I mean, I know we produce most of the world's lithium, for example. But with these particular rare earths, these minerals which are so critical for the making of lightweight modern magnets, it's the processing of these things that seems to be the sticking point. Is that right? You can dig them up, but then you don't dig them up in one lump like you do a lump of iron ore. You dig them up and they're contained inside other things. and you have to separate them all out. And that separating out, the processing of them, can be complex and costly. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. To be honest, we have to do that with all ores, whatever the metals are. You know, if you're looking for copper, it doesn't come out of the ground as copper. It comes out as copper minerals like copper sulfide, so you have to process those. We just know how to do that quite well. Marina was talking about the patents on rare earth technologies that China have. A lot of that is around the technologies that you can use to process the ores.
Right.
And so we haven't got that expertise in yet on the best ways to process rare earth ores. They are very difficult to process. It's very hard to crack those mineral structures that contain the rare earths to get the rare earths out that we need.
This is more complicated than most people realise, isn't it? I remember once on air doing a story about iron ore, for example. It's quite complicated getting iron out of iron ore, as it were, because there are complicated processes to get it. As you say, you don't dig it up and just melt it. And getting these things is infinitely more complex, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. They really don't want to be out of their mineral structures.
Yeah.
And there is also that issue that I mentioned earlier about the coexisting with the rare earths are these radioactive elements, the thorium and uranium. And so whatever process we have of treating these ores and breaking down the minerals and extracting the rare earths, we also have to think about what do we do with those radioactive elements and where do they go in that whole, in the recipe that you put through these materials to try and extract the rare earths, where do the radioactive elements go and can we control where they go and make sure that
they're so it's a messy and nasty process dealing with them.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, there's a few ways around it. If we know enough about the geology and we have enough choice, let's say, we can target those ones where the mineralogy is easier to process. And certainly we're starting to get that information that not all rare earth ores are the same. They're quite variable. And so we could probably pick the ones that are easier to process and also that have lower levels of the radioactive elements. And so that's sort of where we want to get to. We want to have our easier to process ores, which will be less costly and also less costly to the environment, less costly in terms of the resources we need for processing, which include water and energy.
Okay, and talking about minerals and that we are familiar with, we know that WA is the king of iron ore. We know that Queensland's the king of coal, for example. With these things, are we talking about these same areas of Australia, or might these things be found, I don't know, in the highlands of Tasmania, for example?
They could be. There are parts of Tasmania, for example, that where people are looking at rare earths. There are rare earth projects.
Right.
At the moment in Australia, we do have an operating rare earth mine, and that is in Western Australia, the Mount Weld mine run by Lynas. And I think, again, WA does have a good chunk of the resources of rare earths, as well as they have.
How do you dig them up? Is it just a straight open cut, or are they deep underground? Where do you get? How easy is it to mine them?
It will depend on how deep they are. In most cases, it will be an open cut. The size of the mines isn't like the iron ore mines. I mean, anyone's ever been to the mine, iron ore mines in the Pilbara, they're enormous. Or if you've seen the super pit at Kalgoorlie, which is a gold mine, that is an enormous hole in the ground. And that's because the value, there's so much of the metal there that they can make these big holes. We're not talking about mines of that sort of size. They're much, much smaller operations. Yeah,
Lynas does mine here, but I understand they built a processing plant. I think it was in Malaysia, wasn't it? And there were some environmental concerns about that. Do you know the history of that?
I don't know the details. I know I think it was an old Mitsubishi plant that they took over, and a lot of the issues there was around the radioactivity of those materials. The local communities were very concerned about the radioactivity. But they are still operating in Malaysia, so I think that they've probably managed to get through those concerns. But they've also, Lynas are also pretty close to having a plant finished in Kalgoorlie, And the US government has also given them funding to build a plant in Texas. And that sort of is a little bit of an indication of how far the US will also go to being able to secure their own supply of rare earths.
Carl Spandler is with us, a geologist. We're talking about the geopolitics of critical minerals. Marina Zhung is with us as well, professor of at the Australia-China Relations Institute. Marina, you've talked about how China have cornered the market here. Are they attempting to corner the market in mines as well? In other words, are they investing in mines in Australia and elsewhere to lock up supply, as it were?
Not really in Australia, because we know the Australian government is very cautious about allowing Chinese investments into critical mines, critical infrastructures, technology, and so on. But China does control quite a bit of sources of rare earths globally, including Myanmar. That's sort of a kind of a gray zone where China gets quite about half of heavy rare earths. I'm not a geologist, but I just to emphasize the concentration of heavy rare earths, China and Myanmar, perhaps the only place where you can easily mine, extract, and separate heavy rare earths. So that's really, in terms of resources, another choke point China holds.
It might be worth me explaining that a little bit there. I mean, we did talk earlier about the rare earths all behaving in a similar way and being in the same sort of materials, but as Marina said, there is a little bit of a difference there. There's the so-called heavy rare earths and the light rare earths, and that just relates to their atomic mass in the periodic table. And the light rare earths tend to be much more common. So the mine in Western Australia, the Mount Wellwine, produces light rare earths, and one of those light rare earths is neodymium, which is the main rare earth we need for magnets. But there are other rare earths that we need. For example, there's an element called dysprosium, which is a bit of a mouthful. That's a heavy rare earth, and that is important to put in magnets to make sure they work at high temperature. So if you have a wind turbine moving really fast with your electric motor, it gets hot. And to maintain the magnetism, we need to dope it with some of these heavy rare earths. And they are about 10 times less abundant in ores than the light rare earths. So they're much more sought after.
Is China pursuing Marina worldwide, globally? I mean, they control processing, you say, but are they pursuing a strategy of trying to control mining as well?
Yes, of course. China has two strategies. First, over the past 10 to 15 years, China has acquired some overseas suppliers, largely in normal rare earths plus heavy rare earths from Myanmar. Another reason China is doing this strategy is China is conserving its own deposits, especially in heavy rare earths. As we all know, these kind of critical minerals, metals, they're not really renewable. So after you use it, use them. I mean, it takes millions of years to get more. Or, I mean, you can find new deposit, but after 40 years, 50 years, I mean, we pretty much know especially heavy rare earths are concentrated in a kind of a form which are easily or economically to extract in certain areas. So it's not really for heavy rare earths, as Carl just mentioned, dysprosium. They're really very critical for advanced weaponries, fighter jets, and so on.
Do they get consumed in use, Carl, or do they last forever?
Well, the elements themselves don't get consumed, but one of the big problems is that the products that we make from them are so advanced, like your mobile phone, it's very, very difficult. I mean, that's another big challenge that we're going to face is how we recycle them, because the the state at which they've been built is really hard to recycle them. So that's
also you can't get the magnetic materials out of a mobile phone easily.
Not easily. I mean, there's a lot of research groups around the world that are working on this and how do you actually get these things, recover them, and not just rare earths, but there's a whole range. There's 40-plus metals in a mobile phone, including gold, including platinum and things like that. How do we recycle them? And that's a really difficult challenge.
Mm. Apart from Australia, what are the other major suppliers? We've talked about Myanmar. What about India?
So one of the sources of potential sources of rare earths is mineral sands.
Right.
Sands from beaches or that are concentrated by rivers, heavy minerals. Rare earth minerals are often in that mix, along with titanium minerals, etc. And so that's a potential source for rare earths. And India has fairly vast deposits of mineral sands, so they do have the potential to set up rare earth mining in India. One of the challenges there goes back to the radioactivity is that those mineral sands tend to have quite high contents of thorium and uranium. So,
Here we go again.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to pick our poison, so to speak, when we're thinking about which materials to mine.
Interesting. Carl Spandler is our guest, an expert in geology. We're talking about rare earths and rare earth minerals, which are, very much the talking point in international strategic discussions these days because of Chinese control over the supply and processing of so many of them. Marina, it does sound as though there's a 10 to 15 year choke point, you say, here, where China is in the box seat here. The US is trying to diversify supply. I presume other countries are trying to do the same, are they?
Mainly US, because China's targeted export control is at the US, especially military uses.
Mm-hmm.
So, the reality is rare earths and the products exports account for very small financial incentives for China. So China has the way to weaponize it without sacrificing its economic revenues. So, but China so far, people I have talked to, for example, people in South Korea, they are the allies of the United States, but they haven't really felt these kind of choke points of rare earth supplies on them, because China just, licensing a scheme, China just approved the license for them. And China is really targeting at the US.
Mm. Carl, they sound as though they are extraordinarily valuable. Are they? I mean, what's a kilo of these things worth, for example?
That depends when you're asking, to be honest.
Of course, yeah.
and that really is one of the biggest challenges. That sort of raises one of the biggest challenges we have with rare earths, but also critical minerals in general, is that to be able to invest in a project, so if you have a rare earth deposit in the ground and you say it's worth this much, therefore this is how much money we can make by mining it, you're basing that perhaps on today's price, but the lead times between when you identify an ore body in the ground and when you actually get that metal out and can make money on it is usually on the order of a decade, maybe more, 15 years. And so one of the biggest challenges we have is figuring is for these companies that may have an ore body, is actually getting the capital costs to be able to set that up, because an investor is unlikely to invest in a project when they don't necessarily know the return.
Right.
And if you can't know or can't make a fairly good prediction about what the price is going to be next year, let alone 10 years, you're unlikely to invest in that project. And so that the opaque nature of many of the markets for these critical metals and the uncertainty on where the market is going to be is really one of the biggest challenges. The Western world with its sort of
because 20 years ago we didn't realize we'd need so many of them, and now we do.
No, that's right. But China can play the game where they could flood the market, for example, and cause the price to drop and therefore, you know, freeze everyone out of the market. A similar way that Saudi Arabia has done with oil many years ago. It's the same sort of game. The other challenge, of course, is innovation and new technology. I mean, if someone smart person comes along and invents a magnet that doesn't need rare earths, then suddenly that demand is gone and we don't need it anymore. So that technological innovation and invention is actually a good thing. You know, that's advancing our society, but it's also a challenge for mining and production of these metals as well.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, 1300 800 222. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, Carl Spander is a geologist. Marina Jung is an academic and author and a researcher in the geopolitics of a lot of these transformative technologies as well. We're talking about rare earths and critical minerals and the Chinese chokehold on the world's supply and processing of them and how long that might last and what Australia's future in this is as well. Philomena in Sydney says, wondering if rare earth minerals occur in PNG or if any exploration's been done there. Carl?
They could well. It's probably not the place I would go searching for them.
Right.
You'd probably have much better luck looking for copper and gold.
Yeah.
But there is a good possibility. And one area that might be worth looking at is for these heavier rare earths that Marina was talking about, because they often form in clays in tropical environments. And Papua New Guinea being a tropical country with tropical weathering of the surface, there is a possibility you could get those sort of shallow clay-hosted rare earth deposits in PNG.
Brian from WA. G'day, Brian.
Yeah, how are you going, Phil? And good evening to your guests. I just picked up on what Marina has said, that China has these rare minerals, but it's not digging them out of the ground at the moment, so to speak. I'm just wondering the reason for that, whether it's just a strategic thing or whether they just haven't got around to it because they're in control of the processing.
Marina?
I think China just has this plan to build an integrated industry supply chain from mine to downstream products, including EV motors and wind turbos. So China has strategically allowed its state-owned players to go search for mines to acquire them over the past 15 years. And as I said, they do want to conserve their own deposits.
So I just wondered why they're conserving their own, and I presume obviously purchasing other countries. Wouldn't it be cheaper to process their own and then sell it on the market?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are two reasons. First, to conserve their own deposits. Second, as you just hinted, because they control the processing facilities. And countries like the US and Australia, they ship their rare earth products to China for processing. And not just the processing, as Carl mentioned, those rare earth elements, they have very similar chemical properties. So to separate them from one another is very difficult. And to do so, you really need to have hundreds of thousands of hours of manpower to just fine-tune the process. This kind of fantastic knowledge is very hard to build. And so far, China is the only country which provides the most economically viable solutions in separating and processing these elements. So that's why countries visit rare earths, they ship their products to China for processing.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's important to point out that, I mean, China does mine its own rare earths as well, and most of the mobile phones you have or the electric vehicles getting around, even Teslas, the rare earths were mined in China, in one particular place, mostly, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
In the Mongolia. That's light rare earths. That's where China found its rich deposit of rare earths in the 1950s. But that, as Carl mentioned, that type of rare earths is relatively abundant
It is interesting, isn't it? We're talking about rare earths and critical minerals and their supply and abundance. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-300-800-222. David in Dubbo. Hi, David.
Hello. I'm calling from Dubbo, and there's a local company, Australian Strategic Materials, and their concept is from mine to metals. They haven't started their mining, but their processing plant in South Korea seems as though it's reasonably well advanced in producing good quality rare earth metals, priced out of the market by China's low prices, so they haven't been able to do much commercial value yet. Any thoughts on, is that giving them a sort of a head start when it gets to processing?
Carl?
Yeah, that's a really interesting deposit, that the one in near you in Dubbo there. So the company was approached many times by China to work with them, and they made a point of trying not to go with China, and so they did start working with this group in South Korea. It sounds to me, talking to the company, that the technology they've got on board from the South Koreans is quite amazing, because they're not just looking, in that case, at rare earths. They have a whole host of other metals as well, zirconium, niobium, hafnium, etc. So there's an extra value add to that project. And I think that they're probably a good example of how Australia can sort of move beyond just the mining and into the processing. But as you said, they do have challenges as well, because it's still much more expensive for them to process that than what can be done in China. But I hope they get there. They've made great progress on that deposit.
Interesting. Okay. Marina, back to you. I mean, given the market manipulation opportunities, which are so evident, that if there are alternative sources of supply that might threaten the Chinese stranglehold, then they'll simply manipulate the market in the same way that we talked about the oil market. Does this mean that actually if countries want to do anything about this, they're going to actively intervene in the market and actively support, in other words, subsidise the production and manufacture and downstream processing of these things, if they want to combat that? And what's the scale of that kind of intervention? Is it actually practical for governments to do this?
Well, I mean, China is a single entity which, as we just mentioned, owns this integrated supply chain. But the rest of the world, basically, I mean, let's say the Mineral Security Partnership led by the U.S. is a bunch of countries, and each country has its own strategic agenda, objectives. It's very difficult to coordinate. So far, I mean, among this Mineral Security Partnership, Australia is one of the few suppliers. That means the strategic alignments between the U.S., Washington, and Canberra actually are quite different, because Washington concerns about the security of the supply chains of critical minerals or rare earths, but Australia actually concerns about the buyers and the processors, which is China.
Yeah.
So how can countries like this, with different agendas, with different objectives, to work together to use government subsidies to support a supply chain which actually, well, to be fair, I mean, to provide the security of the supply of military, a defense use, that accounts for less than 1% of the total demand for rare earth products and magnets.
Okay.
So most countries like the EU, Japan, I mean, they want to have, they use their feet to vote which buyers they go to choose, right? Because they need magnets to in the EV in their electronic products, in the EV productions, and you know, but Australia doesn't have that downstream market. Australia is a supplier, so this is the tricky point of the game in geopolitics.
Yeah, I see it. I see it. I love these topics because they turn out to be way more complicated when you start talking about them than they might seem on the surface, which I suppose, Carl, is something that you've understood for a long time, and Marina, you certainly have as well. I wonder whether the rest of us have. I hope this is giving us some insight into the issue of the problem. Again, getting back onto the rarity of them, Carl, it's not as though the Earth's about to run out of these things.
No.
I mean, there's a relatively inexhaustible supply by the sound of it.
Yeah, I think so. We don't have a shortage in terms of where we could get them from. The challenges are having the multiple challenges. One is how do we get around those market dynamics? And that really probably means we need government intervention to do it. And I think that government is moving that way. We need, one of the challenges I think we face in Australia, and Marina touched on this, Australia, we're used to digging and shipping. We do that with iron ore. We dig it up.
Exactly. Not good at processing. We've historically not been good at this. We're very good at digging it up and putting it in chips and sending it overseas. That's right.
Yeah. So there is a bit of a push now to say, let's at least go further down that value chain. Let's do at least some of the processing. If we're going to do that, one of the missing pieces of the puzzle is the human capacity to do it, the human skills. Right. And that's something that I think Australia needs to have a really cold, hard look at, is where is that that skills base coming from? Because we have a shortage of the sort of...
What sort of skills are these? Are these geological skills, or what are they?
Yeah, I mean, they are geological. We do need more geologists. There is a supply shortage coming of geologists. We need more mining engineers, for sure. We really don't have many mining engineers going many mining engineering programs in universities.
In a country like ours, which is full of mines, really?
Yeah, that's right. Part of the problem is definitely the public perception of mining, and so that turns people off. But, it's not that, in terms of pay and remuneration, these are very high paid salaries, but we just, they're not jobs that kids want to do these days.
Right. That's very interesting. Yeah.
And so we need those people. We need people who know how to, chemical engineers to process the ores and do this in an effective way, in a way that doesn't ruin the environment and so on. And we need... people who are trained across a broad range of areas that can understand the social aspects of mining. What does that mean for local communities, and making sure that the local communities and the pastoralists and the traditional owners are actually involved in the process, and those benefits of mining flow all the way through. So there are all sorts of challenges that we face.
Interesting.
In that regard.
Gary says, are there enough rare earths and other materials like lithium, aluminium and copper in Australia that we could feasibly produce a 100% Australian battery for every home in the country? I suppose the answer is yes. Is that Gary? Is that Carl?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you remember, Australia has a relatively small population, so we could easily do that. In fact, what we feasibly could do is actually be providing those products for Europe and for the US and the rest of the world. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Fascinating. Marina, thank you for explaining it because it's been, as I say, I think a lot of people get puzzled by these things, but when you dig into it, as you two have, you begin to understand that it actually is not quite as simple as it sounds. And certainly every time I've discussed geology and the extraction of ores, this is something that that has always fascinated me. My guests tonight have been Marina Zhong, who's an associate professor at the Australia-China's China Relations Institute. Marina, terrific to have your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Carl Spander is a professor at the University of Adelaide, a geologist and mineralogist as well. And thanks, Carl, for explaining where these things come from and what they're used for, and how relatively difficult it is to get them out of the ground and put to good use. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. Great to be on the program.
Yeah, good on you. Interesting. I hope you found that useful. I certainly did.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.